Okay, so to continue, I'm wondering, so can you tell me a little bit more about your educational background?
Yeah, sure. I went to Lehigh University to graduate school. I had a bachelor's degree from Boston University in geology, but it was in mostly rocks. I intended to continue that, and I went to Lehigh University, and it was a fellowship to study salt marshes. So I did, and I got interested in it, and it was a whole new world. I loved it, and I finished my master's. Just as I was finishing, I was looking at other graduate schools. It's a continuous similar line. When my wife, who is now my wife, came in as a grad student, so I stayed for PhD at Lehigh, when she got her master's. We went to New Orleans after that. I taught at the University of New Orleans from 1979 to 1982. She worked for an oil company, and it was great, except we didn't really like the political climate, the climate, and but I did like the coast, and I wrote a book on it. It was the last things I did when I was there. I wrote a book on it, and I've been involved, remain involved ever since then on National Academy panels and other things dealing with the loss of land there. But a position opened in the early 80s here at Maine, two of them, one in the department, one with the Maine Geological Survey, and I took the latter. I'd been tired of just teaching a lot, and so I worked 17 years as the state's marine geologist, but I was based here primarily to just get grants, work with students. I taught a little, but that wasn't required. And then in the 90s, I got kind of put out by the state, and I decided I wanted to have a full-time academic position and got some offers from other places, and when that happens, suddenly you appear golden, and they want you to stay, and they wanted me to stay, and so I stayed. And so since then, I've been the head of the department here for 5 years, and but I've been involved in what was the Quaternary Institute and is now the Climate Change Institute since the day I arrived, really.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how you got involved in the Quaternary Institute. Did somebody like Hal Borns contact you, or?
Absolutely. Hal Borns was one of the people who wrote a research proposal that funded the other position here at the University of Maine in coastal geology. And so it was natural that we worked near one another. Our first project, I was given this project, we worth millions of dollars, to decide whether or not Maine had, was tectonically active, whether there were earthquake potentials. And the reason was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was considering putting a high-level radioactive dump site in some state. Maine ended up going potentially to Nevada, but so we were interested in looking at all manner of coastal things. There were rumors, and Hal and others had come up, that Eastport, the down east area of Maine, was sinking excessively rapidly. So understanding sea level became a really important thing to do here. I came here with my colleague Dan Belknap, began a series of investigations into changes in the relative level of the ocean all along the Maine coast, first now in sort of real time and going back thousands and thousands of years as far back as the Ice Age. And I'd never done that kind of work ever before, but it was really interesting and I could see how important it was. And that's how I really came to know Hal Borns more. And he became interested in having me lead field trips for their group, and wasn't actually a member formally. I mean, I don't know what constituted membership. I wasn't a regular faculty member here, mm-hmm. but I went on their field trips and was involved in a research proposal we all developed. It just happened over time that I was officially a member, and there was never a ceremony or anything. It's much more formal today, but then it was not. You just got invited to come on trips to meet with people. They'd have speakers. Well, that was open to anybody. Mm-hmm. And so I just went into it naturally, working on a project originally and then just continuing to work on projects with people and being associated with them.
Mm-hmm. Other than Dan Belknap, were there any other faculty members in the Institute with whom you've done research?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Certainly Hal Borns on things sort of related to sea level. George Jacobson and I got a research proposal a number of years ago to work on salt marshes, and we'd even begun that a little earlier, but we continued to work on salt marshes. I provided research grants to David Smith, an historian, for a while for his work on salt marshes, and we collaborated to the degree that I edited his manuscripts. He wrote some rough first drafts, and but that worked out. And oh dear, I probably worked with plenty of others, but mostly people who would be working not exclusively, but for some reason in a coastal area for something.
Mm-hmm.
Now Brian Olson happens to study salt marshes and birds. I've worked with him lately. And I'm going to the Shetland Islands soon with Brenda Hall, the Falkland Islands, I'm sorry, with Brenda Hall and Jacqueline Gill, and we're about to try to begin some research projects there. So a lot of people, not all by any means, and often not regularly. It was one project that we got together, we had a common interest, and we worked on it, and we published it, and do different things, just never got back to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm wondering maybe if we can hone in on one of those instances of cooperation among members of the Institute. Could you maybe go in a little more detail about your collaboration with Hal?
Sure. Hal, again, was one of the initiators of what was called an EPSCoR, the Experimental Program to Study... It was a National Science Foundation effort to create a more competitive University of Maine on a national level. As an author of that, he had interest in the geologists they hired succeeding, and by my association, me too. We worked on a project on salt marshes, and we were interested in how fast sea level was growing adjacent to them, and because that drives salt marshes, they're always graded to mean high water. And so we were interested. Hal didn't really have any background in this, and I was able to provide him with somebody who knew the geography of the coast well, places to go, things to do, and that part in particular worked out well. He was fun to work with in the field, never really ever complained about anything. He went off from that for a bit and into areas I didn't think were quite valid. The thought that down East Maine was really sinking radically really posed a question to us. Was it really doing that? And there were a variety of pieces of evidence that suggested it, but most tellingly was a survey done by a survey engineer here who was, I assume, was sort of a member of the Quaternary Institute, Dave Tyler. And, you know, they'd just done, this is the first order level network of the United States, highly, highly precise survey. And he looked at older versions of surveys, and it showed that the elevations had changed over time. And when he looked at them statewide, Eastport, Maine was a bullseye of sinking, you know, up to a meter per year. There were other things that seemed to lend credence to that, and I actually wrote a paper for the group, for the biggest journal in all the geosciences, it's called Geology, about, and we described crustal warping in coastal Maine. And it was great. It's a very prominent journal. I was happy that they made me a co-author, though I actually contributed nothing other than I went home one weekend and wrote the paper. But it turned out it was wrong, and we got a call from MIT from a man named Nafi Taksaz, who was a brilliant MIT seismologist, said, "This is incredible. If that area is sinking, I've got to know more about this." We weren't able to reach any kind of a deal with Nafi to work with him because the overhead at MIT was 125%. Maine wouldn't pay. We wouldn't pay someone that much money just for the privilege of working. But we provided them with all our information, and then sometime later we got a call from one of his postdoctoral students saying, "Boy, he looked at these surveys, and they were systematically in error." And he came to us to visit, and I listened, and they were. They just, if you begin the survey at one elevation and you measure, everything is relative to your starting point, you can propagate errors. And an error was propagated, and other surveys didn't show this sinking. So there was one error that by chance was the one that was used that was an error, and so he wrote he wanted to do something about it. Others did not. Hal particularly didn't agree with them, but I didn't have any argument. I couldn't... In fact, the Dave Tyler, who had done this, said absolutely he was wrong, this fellow was right, and that we should he should write a comment. And so he wrote a comment to the journal, and Hal wanted me to write a reply, but I couldn't because I couldn't comment on it. It looked right to me. I think, science ends up right in the end. We disagree, but then we find that, there is no sinking in Downey's Mean. And the more we've looked into it, two PhD theses, looking at sea level change in coastal Maine from Eastport to Kittery, practically, over the past 5,000 years, showed absolutely no difference at all. I mean, this was really conclusive, and each of these PhD students, went on to great careers. So, I'm convinced that that survey was an error, and but there's always a long. It took a period of 5 years, probably, to get through working on things, seeing things published. Some of the maps you see in my office here, this bedrock and glacial map, all came from that project. It was all ultimately funded by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission because they were looking to put some radioactive waste, or not, but they wanted to know if this was a suitable location for it.
And this map, I presume, is accurate.
Oh, yes, it is. In fact, it's quite accurate. And that works on more work. Like, on this map, is a glacial superficial geologic map. There's a dark blue line that maps the inland limit that the ocean went at the end of the Ice Age. And then there's little pink units on it that map deltas that would give you a really good position of the shoreline.
Oh, that's as far as the ocean reached, you say?
Yes,
Oh,
but all the
wow.
way into almost Millinocket in this valley.
Okay.
But they also are at a common elevation, suggesting, again, there's been no rapid sinking or uplift or any change in the land level. So, it's quaternary science. That's not climate science. And this wasn't really, I mean, we were looking at sea level change. Well, that's climate driven. But this was driven by a need to know whether this was a tectonically stable area, a need to understand sea level change. And that's an inherently a climate, for the most part, a climate driven process, not everywhere. So that got me involved pretty heavily with Hal. There was a book that I edited that the group put out, and so we worked together as a team for quite some time. That's how I met many of the other people in the Quaternary Institute. There weren't that many then. I mean, there were seven or eight at the most. And George Jacobson was one, and then I, it was through talking with him on that project that we got into other projects together. And so it's been a good association, but not forced. I don't feel like I have to go out and find someone there to work with tomorrow. I still continue to work with Dan Belknap, my colleague from the early 80s, who's also a member of the Institute. And, other things as they come up. If I have an idea that makes sense, then I'll find somebody to work with who knows, who can work with me on something or other.
So it sounds like you've worked with some geologists.
That's correct.
Have you worked with many scientists outside the realm of geology?
Yeah, well, Dave Smith was a historian. They passed away. Dave Sanger is retired. Dave is an archaeologist, and I became interested. We became interested in sea level change because it was eroding coastal middens, his archaeological deposits on usually right near the ocean. And he took a strong interest in sea level change. We were on students' master's theses together. He and I never wrote a paper together, but my wife eventually ended up doing her PhD thesis with Dave. Never worked with Ron Davis, who was very much like George Jacobson, was a botanist. Just because George and I came closer in our interests to coastlines. Ron was more interested in inland plant communities. George Denton, I never had occasion to work with. I mean, his work was always in Antarctica at that time, and I didn't work there. Again, I worked for the state at this time, so I had to really restrict myself. So that's about that.
Yeah. What were some of the day-to-day things you did when you worked for the Maine Geological Survey?
I was given a state truck, a state credit card, and one day a week I was to drive that to Augusta to attend a staff meeting and other business as it would come up. I reviewed every application to alter the coast. I wrote the rules that govern development on beaches and salt marshes and everything like that. And I would defend those rules. I had to go to public hearings. I had to hold them myself. But being from the university and the Climate Change Institute was a real advantage. I had hard new information on sea level change in the area, and I could talk seriously about what risk that posed to the state. So one or more days a week, I was involved in purely state activities, but often they played back. There was money available to state agencies, not available to universities, and I would get a grant and bring it back here and work with someone or other on projects. But mostly, I would come back here and do what I'm doing now, write papers, work with data that's been collected, go into the field. I've told my children I was away 5 out of every 7 days in the summer, most of their early lives, because we had to work summers on boats because of weather, and we had a lot of projects, and so we were just offshore all the time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it, I wasn't here, I wasn't around at all. I was working out on boats. Mm-hmm. I mean, not all the coastal work we do is land. I'd say 3/4 of it is out in the ocean.
Okay, so you're working on boats, something geologically related.
Yeah, for the most part. Sometimes marine science, sometimes habitats on the bottom. Nobody in climate change was in that then, but it was didn't matter to me. I mean, I was interested in that. Mm. The sea level change was my strongest connection to the Climate Change Institute, to the Quaternary Institute, and the response of shorelines and their inhabitants, meaning people for the most part, but plant communities and some animals, to changes in sea level. How does a sand beach respond to rising sea level as opposed to a salt marsh or tidal flat or other landforms? Mm.
You mentioned that much of your work didn't necessarily have to do directly with climate change. What did you think when the name was changed from the Quaternary Institute to the Climate Change Institute?
I was in the room when we made the agreement, too. I remember it. It was fairly recently. Paul Mavsky was the new director, and he had proposed a climate change institute for his own group that he'd recently brought from the University of New Hampshire. He wasn't at the meeting, though. We were talking about that name. The problem with quaternary had come up. I always said, well, let's make it an educational term, that when the reporter asks you, what's a quaternary? You could explain there was once a primary, secondary, tertiary quaternary, and we don't use the early ones. We still use the quaternary, and it represents an interval of time during which there were ice ages and other things. People came into existence. But it was Dan Sandweiss who said it most persuasively. He said, he's an anthropologist. Said, there's a lot of importance attached to names. He said it... Climate Change Institute, everybody knows what that is, and at that time people were coming to become interested in climate change more and more. Said maybe we don't want that to be a little institute, you know, that's attached to our bigger institute. Maybe we ought to be the Climate Change Institute and just drop the whole discussion and all the arguments we've had over decades on the word quaternary, and make Paul the director. And first, it didn't make sense, but then it really did make sense. As it was with Paul, was working in the Greenland Ice Core and was doing phenomenal research. He had lots of people, postdocs and grad students. It was almost a tail wagging the dog if he was this little institute attached to ours, since he was a good part of the total number of projects and people in the group at the time. So he was approached and accepted that responsibility, and we changed the name then to the Climate Change Institute. I don't know if there was ever a vote. I would have voted for it. Initially, I wasn't, but I got persuaded that it was a really good idea. And in retrospect, I still think it was probably a good idea. Hmm.
What do you think has been the Institute's most important contribution to our understanding of climate?
That's a hard question. If you pick out a single... And there's so many people. I mean, I wrote Maine sand dune laws and all that, but George Denton, you know, has discovered in part how ice ages end and has made tremendous inroads into understanding why climate has changed. So I mean, everybody's work is really in their niche in climate change has been a really important contribution. Overall, one of the greatest contributions we've probably made is to produce a lot of students who have left here. We didn't have a PhD program then. We don't now in quaternary in climate change, but they get degrees in other areas. But a lot of students have come through here, and many of them have gone on to really outstanding careers. And that is the most general and specifically concrete thing we've done. Details, resolving this technical problem, posing certain problems that have been interesting questions, all of that has occurred, but it's hard for me to weight that. I know my field, but I don't know other fields so specifically well, particularly plants and biological dimensions. But maybe it was just the whole idea of having a climate change institute that we would focus on climate change and what results from that might have been an important contribution in and of itself, mainly because our students have gone on and they've continued to have these ideas of an institute in mind. Mm. Whenever I see some of them, I bring them T-shirts from the Climate Change Institute so they'll stay in touch.
Oh, well, that's a good incentive.
Well, that's easy enough.
Mm. So moving from the institute's contributions, what is the contribution you've made that you would say you're most proud of?
Probably it was in developing the rules, now it's a law, that governs the response of the citizens of this state to one aspect of climate change, and that's rising sea level. It doesn't say that exactly in the rules and certainly not in the law, but it was clear to me and from talking to some colleagues that sea level and coastlines were antagonistic toward one another, and that the best response that I could discern for people on beaches was basically to move back and get out of the way rather than armor the coastline and turn it into a rocky coast, of which we had many. And so I promoted that in rules that we, and again, it was based on the data from various projects that sea level was clearly rising here faster than it had risen in thousands of years by orders of magnitude. So the shoreline we look at in Maine formed over thousands of years, but it's transforming now. It's changing into something else because sea level's rising so quickly. And so we wrote rules that said basically you can't build seawalls. That was the first time in the world that anybody, any entity had said you couldn't build seawalls. That if your wall or house behind it was destroyed by a storm, you had to take it down, and you had to do it at your expense, and you couldn't rebuild, and the land was now gone. That you couldn't build buildings that were unmovable, like high-rise buildings on the Maine coast. And I think 35 feet was dictated to be the upper limit that was an easily movable structure. And so we wouldn't permit anything larger than that on the immediate coastline. There are many details to the rules, and they've evolved a little bit over time. You're allowed to rebuild once today. That was a concession made to make the rules, which were made by people like us, by bureaucrats, into a law that is the law passed by the legislature. It's very hard to change a law. Rules can be changed easily, but laws, boy, it's... Once you have a law, it's very, very strong and not likely to change easily. And so I thought that concession was worthwhile because we got a lot out of it by having this codified and not having to fight with homeowners and things like that anymore.
Right.
So understanding of sea level change has been big, and that's what drove that. And we probably have the best understanding of sea level change here than really almost anywhere in the world, because we've gone offshore and followed it in. Where we're working right now, several of us, Dan Belknap and I, are working in Ireland, looking to see whether England and Ireland were ever connected by land or whether it was always ocean. It was always ocean. But that's not what our archaeologists always thought. They were land bridges, and people walked across, and as the bridges broke down, culture changed. Well, that's not true. It didn't happen like that at all. So that whole project was a million-pound research project, came from our earlier work here. So things lead from one thing to the next, and I'd like to think that the beach law is done. It's the law and it's going to stand. Seven other states copied it shortly thereafter, which was nice. The sea level work is probably going to be ongoing. The details we don't understand. But, so.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the Institute has changed since you first got involved in it?
In a single word, it's grown. It's grown immensely. And it's grown from an entity that was probably not recognized by many people as being on a cutting edge, although it was from the beginning. As climate has become known, the fact that we have this institute here has become known. It's grown, though. It's grown tremendously in numbers of people, and that's changed some of the overall character of the group. It's hard to have a meeting in one small room. We had this one table we all sat around, and now it's almost no, and very few people sit at the table now, because if they do, you can't see them, so people sit around a room. I don't even know some of the people. I don't know how people were admitted originally. I think it was by Hal Boyne's coming up and saying, why don't you come on this field trip with us, and it'd be good if you did, or work on this project. Now, if you want to become a member, you give a talk, you request to become a member. This year, I'm on the review committee. I don't think anyone's ever been turned down. So it's grown in a way that isn't an intimate group of friends anymore, although we do make efforts to stay together. We're going out to I like to call it a prom, but we're going out to a formal restaurant and a formal dinner as a group tomorrow night. We'll have a field trip in a couple of weeks to a coastal place in Maine. And everybody's invited. Not everybody can go, but that's always been the case. And everybody contributes to those. Everybody talks. And so there have been changes, mostly in the size and in the breadth, but the field has changed immensely. It's hard for me to understand really what some of the people in the cyber dimension are working on. I mean, data mining, I know, and it's climate. But I couldn't tell you much more than that for Chaw's work or some other people's work in the Institute. So we've become a bit more distant. That doesn't mean we don't still work. I mean, I still work with people, that I've always really worked with. And it's nice to meet these other people. And I particularly have enjoyed meeting Brian Olson, who's in the School of Biology and Ecology. He studies salt marshes, but he studies birds in salt marshes, and that's... It's really interesting. It gives me a whole other dimension and something I thought I knew a great deal about. And so we've changed in size and in intimacy, but not in overall intent. I think people still seek to collaborate with one another. We have the Bourne Symposium every year. We all get a chance to hear what everyone else is doing at the prom. I keep calling it a prom, but at the gala or dinner we're going to have tomorrow night, everybody will give a 90-second presentation of what they're interested in, so the new students will have some idea what other faculty members work on.
Mm-hmm.
And we have projects. I mean, IGRT, the big integrated graduate student research and training fellowships. I was involved in that. That was a climate change submission. Jasmine Saros headed it up, and I actually had a student in it. Unfortunately, dropped out, but mm-hmm. I am involved and hope to be involved in that with that group once again.
Mm-hmm. So, what sorts of things will you do at your annual field trip?
Okay. We're going to be going down east to Petimanan Island or Great Wass Island, something in this down east part of the coast that's fairly remote. There's Federal Wildlife Refuge there. And somebody will have initiated this. I think it was George Jacobson. There are a lot of wetlands, freshwater wetlands there. Well, my interest in freshwater wetlands, I just finishing a grant studying what happens when the ocean encounters a freshwater wetland. The erosion happens, and suddenly the wetland is, freshwater and saltwater come together, and we've measured rates of change. And I suspect I'll have occasion to expound on that when we stand near such an environment there. But George will talk about the plants. He'll have had the idea of getting us to that place. And then anybody who wants can offer, somebody will mention what the rocks are made of. biology people will be there. They'll talk about things I can't even guess, but there's always regular contributions from people. There'll probably be several stops where we'll look at one thing primarily, but then, again, people continue to talk. And a lot of the parts of the trip, though, are just having private conversations with somebody while you're walking and having dinner and being closer to them. The university precludes us from having families come anymore. It used to be everybody's family came, so you could know someone, a colleague, their wife, their children, but they don't allow us to do that anymore, which is unfortunate. So if they come, and they likely will, they'll be coming in separate cars, which is contrary to our views as climate change scientists, but that's the way it's been dictated to us. So for the last few years, we've been compelled to do something a bit different.
So you'll go in university vehicles and your family?
Well, my wife is, my children are all grown up. One is a climate change PhD student at the University of Buffalo. Since my wife is also a member, we'll ride with the bus, and there will be, I presume, yeah, there is a bus.
Mm-hmm.
We used to ride on school buses with no restrooms and those little seats. Now I think they're going to have a regular, like, Sears line, like a nice tourist bus.
Right.
I hope.
Well, one hopes.
Yeah.
How supportive has been the University of Maine of the Institute over the years?
Well, broadly supportive, I'd say, and, you know, it's mutually beneficial. The grants come in, they get the indirect costs. They've been supportive, probably most importantly, in hiring people, new positions. Hal's idea of jointly hiring somebody with money from the climate change, you know, the Quaternary Institute, and then money that comes through a different route to a department to get George Jacobson's replacement position. Jacqueline Gill got the position, but I think her salary is half tied to climate change. So when she goes up for a tenure or promotion, her peer review committee will contain both people from her department as well as people from the Climate Change Institute. In doing that and in being able to work with the university and finding that there's two people wanting this position to be created, both the departments and the institute have benefited tremendously. So to that, the Institute is tremendously indebted to the university for, and it goes down not to the university in a, you know, monolithic sense, but to individuals, vice presidents for research in various times, or deans who were really saw that as a strength, look at the Institute, say, oh, all that research money, all those papers, all those students, why not get another person who's part there and solve this other problem? They need someone to teach a course here, and we'll get one person. And it's been a relatively easy argument to make, and it's been a successful one. Mm-hmm. When I was head of the department, we were able to demonstrate that, you know, loss of this one person due to retirement was, you know, he'd worked with a lot of different people, so we really wanted to replace that, and it was not a hard sell. At a time when there was nobody being replaced or hired, we hired a new person,
mm-hmm.
completely new. So it's been very beneficial in that sense. I wouldn't have anything negative to say. The university's always been pretty helpful to us.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of the bus trip, not letting our families come on the bus trip. Sore point, because it was the money we use to travel is not university money. It's an endowment gift. And it's specifically for things like that, but for whatever reason, the university has not allowed that.
Huh. Interesting. So it seems to me that within the scientific community, there's no real debate about climate change and the human role in that. But outside the scientific community, it's still an issue up for debate. Why, do you have any guesses as to why that might be the case?
Well, one might expand that and go, well, it's the case in the United States. It's not the case in Europe. Europeans are quite accepting of the fact that the climate is changing. Maybe they've got a longer historical record. They can see there used to be a town here and now it's underwater, that they've seen a longer, I don't mean scientists have, but I mean people are familiar with that as populations. But in the United States, that's not the case. And so what's up here? I think it's, in part, it's ignorance. You know, there's people simply don't know certain things. and there are those who don't like the penalty of the knowledge. If I know climate is changing and I'm causing it, you know, I really am kind of compelled to do something maybe about it because it's probably not going to be beneficial. Oil companies, huge corporations, for example, don't want to be targeted like the tobacco companies were and someday be told, you owe us billions for all the climate change you caused. And so they've been deniers. And so between, you know, major companies, coal, that benefit from things that change the climate, people who are generally ignorant, and unfortunately, the issue became something of a Democratic-Republican divide. That's the biggest problem. I mean, there are plenty of Republicans who understand climate is changing, and members of the Institute, for that matter. But I think if you look as a group, most of the people who don't accept climate is changing are probably conservative Republicans who don't really know why. They couldn't explain to you in much detail why they don't accept that it's changing or why humans are responsible, but they've heard this where they get their information from various news outlets, media outlets, and their own friends. And so a hard body of people have come into existence who don't accept it. But when I sit down one-on-one and know something about it, I don't find them able to, universally, never able to defend their own opinions, even though they're fairly strongly held opinions. Don't know that I persuade them necessarily, but they're caused to think about it. They can't explain why, you know, if I say you're introducing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere year after year after year, we understand what that does. We can do experiments with little glass boxes called greenhouses, and we can see what it does. We know that it's, but the Earth isn't as simple as a greenhouse. It's vastly more complicated with ice, water, and atmospheric H2O that, well, we're figuring out how Earth's climate works, but unfortunately it's changing even as we do that. They'll follow you along. They don't have any arguments against it, but in the end they don't want to accept that that people are responsible. That they'll turn around and blame a Democratic politician. Barack Obama is just saying that. Well, he didn't have anything to do with it. The Institute would have existed long before there were those kind of political dimensions, and we're honest people. There was a time when I think many of us thought we're going to get an ice age before we'd see any warming, because we're in a time when one should be on our doorstep, but it's not. And in fact, that alone sobers me up and goes, what's going on? So it's become political, and that's why it's really as strong a movement as it is. Europeans are no smarter than we are, but it's more of a popular culture of understanding that climate has changed. They went through the Little Ice Age, the medieval warm period. It's part of their culture. Kids learn this in school, that, you know, the canals used to freeze, and now they don't freeze. And they used to grow grapes in Britain, and now they can grow grapes again in Britain. That's kind of changed the other way. But for a time, they could not. So they're much more familiar with it, and most people in the world, if scientists say it in China or other parts of Asia, then they have no reason to doubt it. They don't have any independent knowledge. It's here where facts themselves are challenged, but not on the basis of superior facts. Just, I don't know. I don't want to just say there's a lot of dumb people, because there are plenty of smart people who just don't understand this, but in my experience, when someone has a discussion with a knowledgeable person and they don't have their peers around to support them and maybe feed them information, well, they kind of come around and say, I guess it must be. And then once you say that, you go, well, you know, what should we do about it? And that starts out the discussions. It is odd, though. I mean, it is certainly, I don't have the last word on why in this country things are different. And if you look at it regionally, people in the Northeast are probably more likely to accept climate change than people in the South. But there's a political boundary there also. So, yeah.
Well, that's about all the questions I have. But before concluding the interview, I wanted to give you a chance to add anything that maybe I didn't ask you about.
When you look back at the Institute, I've heard Hal Bourne's asked many times, how did he come up with it? And he'll explain it as, but I don't think it happened that way. I think it's an easy way to say, well, these are the series of events that happened historically, but But I don't think from the get-go, Hellborn's ever had in mind that this institute we have today would ever be like it is. It's been one step at a time, one very small step at a time, that many have tried to generalize and say, well, Hal had this stroke of genius to create the institute. It was a stroke of genius, but I don't think there was any thought Hal could have foreseen where we went. And in every instance, bringing Paul in and making the Climate Change Institute, I think we're still kind of finding out what the impact of that is. I mean, what's it going to mean? I don't think it's played out yet. It's going to result in other changes. So the history of the Institute is not a history of one major incident, and then it's just a continuously evolving set of interpersonal relationships between people and nature, really. And it's been a great mechanism for us to collaborate together. I wouldn't know anything about plants, really, without George Jacobson taking me out and explaining all of that to me. And other things. And other people might say the same about what I've told them about things. So it's been a really beneficial relationship, and one that's continuing. So that's about it.
All right. Okay. Thank you. And just to reiterate, today is September 18th, 2013, and this was an interview with Joe Kelly here in his office. I'll stop the recording.